Can faith and reason work together, or are they somehow mutually exclusive? What role do facts and evidence play when it comes to the Christian faith? This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and on behalf of Dr. Craig, I want to welcome you to this discussion as Dr. Craig examines apologetics, reason, faith, and philosophy. There has been an amazing renaissance, and it's recent, of Christian philosophers who are very influential in doing terrific work at some of the higher institutions of learning. And Bill, you've seen this firsthand.
Yes, I began to study philosophy of religion really during the late 1960s and 1970s. And it was just about that time that I think the corner was turned and the secularism that had been predominant in American philosophy began to unravel. And over the last 40 years, there has been this tremendous renaissance of Christian philosophy in the Anglo-American realm.
What caused this?
Well, I think one of the principal causes motivating this renaissance was the collapse of verificationism. Now, verificationism was a philosophy that dominated philosophy and philosophy of science during the first half of the 20th century. And in a nutshell, what verificationism held to was that if you can't verify something with your five senses, then it's meaningless. That would be it in a nutshell. If you can't touch it, smell it, taste it, feel it, or see it, it's meaningless. Well, since you can't verify statements about God, like God loves me or God sent his son into the world, these sorts of statements, theological statements, were regarded as meaningless. They were thought to be combinations of words that was just like baby talk or like gibberish. To say God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life is like saying, "'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe." Just complete nonsense. And this theory of meaning dominated philosophy up through the 1930s and 40s, and as a result meant that the whole project of theology, of religious belief, was a meaningless exercise. So this involved a very condescending attitude toward people who believed in God or thought religious language was meaningful. For the cognoscendi, the intelligentsia who knew better, they could look down on these people as folks who were just uttering gibberish, just meaningless chatter like a chimpanzee, and therefore were disdained and looked down upon. And what happened was verificationism collapsed during the second half of the 20th century.
Somebody found a chink in the armor.
I'll say, big time.
Somebody found that that principle refutes itself.
Well, they did, Kevin. There were two things that were discovered about this verification principle of meaning. First was that it would not only eliminate as meaningless theological statements, but it would also consign to the trash heap of meaningless vast tracts of ordinary language and discourse, such as metaphysical statements, aesthetic statements, and even scientific statements, so that science itself, which was the sacred cow for the verificationists, science itself would be undermined by the verification principle, so that the principle was seen to be wholly unreasonable. It was too restrictive a criterion of meaning because it would make vast, vast stretches of human language and discourse, which we obviously understand, meaningless. But then secondly, as you pointed out, it turned out that the principle was self-refuting. Just ask yourself the question, is the statement, in order to be meaningful, a statement must be verifiable by the five senses? Is that statement verifiable by the five senses?
No.
Well, no, obviously not. It's just a definition, just an arbitrary definition, and not even a very good one at that.
Now, we can hear an expression of it. We can see it written, but that's not the proposition itself. We can't detect that with the five senses.
No, and we can't do any scientific tests. There's nothing you could do in the laboratory, no experiment you could perform to prove that in order to be meaningful, a sentence must be capable of being verified by the five senses. It's just an arbitrary definition. And therefore, by its own lights, being non-verifiable, it's meaningless. So it turned out that the verification principle, by its own criterion of meaning, is itself a meaningless statement, which hardly needs to detain us.
So you're saying the principle of verification failed the principle of verification.
Exactly. And so it became—
So you throw it out.
Yes, it became very obvious that as a self-refuting principle, this could not be the correct criterion of meaning.
Where did that come from? Who was saying that? Who was writing on this?
Well, one of the most prominent philosophers who was saying this was Antony Flew.
Really?
Back in 1948, Antony Flew participated in a symposium at Oxford University called Theology and Falsification, in which he argued that statements about God were incapable of being falsified. That was a sort of mirror image of verification, falsification, and therefore theological statements are meaningless. And Flew created a huge hubbub back in the late 40s and 1950s because of his defense of this falsification principle and his claim that theological language is meaningless.
Now, at this recording, Antony Flew has moved away from atheism.
This is just one of the manifestations of this renaissance that I'm talking about, is that now this man, who as far back as 1948, think of the influence he has had, has been a prominent atheistic philosopher, now within the last couple of years, said that he is now a theist and believes on the basis of the evidence that there is a designer of the universe who is beyond the universe and who has designed it and brought it into being.
So Professor Antony Flew is one manifestation of this. What are some other manifestations?
Well, some of the other manifestations would be the founding of a number of societies which are devoted to the propagation of Christian philosophy. For example, the Society of Christian Philosophers, which now has hundreds, if not thousands, of members in it, as well as the Evangelical Philosophical Society, which is relatively recent and is the only society of philosophers in the world which is devoted to explicitly evangelical points of view on philosophy. I'm currently serving as the president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and our journal, Philosophia Christi, has now become one of the leading journals in philosophy of religion in the world, and our society is now one of the largest societies of philosophy of religion in the world, and it is explicitly and confessionally evangelical. This would just be one manifestation of this Renaissance. In addition to this, there would be the founding of numerous other journals for the study of philosophy of religion, journals like Religious Studies, the International Journal for Philosophy of Religion, Sophia, and so forth. Many professional journals now are devoted to the integration of philosophy and religion. And this has caused tremendous resurgence of interest in university campuses for courses in philosophy of religion. And so students are clamoring for courses on this subject, and this has in turn evoked a flood of textbooks in philosophy of religion. Almost every major textbook publisher now is putting out a textbook in philosophy of religion. For example, Rutgers University Press, very liberal Eastern press, contacted me and said, "Would you please edit for us a book of readings on philosophy of religion that could be a textbook at universities for courses on this subject?" And so I said, "You bet I will." And I put together a very evangelical collection of first-rate work in philosophy of religion that is virtually all from a Christian perspective, defending the existence of God, answering the problem of evil, explaining the coherence of theism, defending the Trinity and incarnation. And after I had submitted this to them, I said to the editors at Rutgers University Press, "You know, this collection that I've put together for you is very conservative." And they said, "Yes, we know. That's why we wanted it." And I was just astonished that people want this kind of evangelical work. In fact, if you look at Oxford University Press's current catalog of offerings, there are far more books now published by Oxford University Press on philosophy of religion than in metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of science. It is philosophy of religion, and many of those books are written by conservative Christians. Oxford University Press is now starting to publish books on Christian apologetics. Can you imagine that?
Bill, this is such good news. And one thing that should be pointed out is that although the university is discovering these things, you still run into this on the street among lay people and freshmen in college. They'll say, if I can't see it, taste it, hear it, smell it, and so forth, then it must not be real.
Yes, and they don't understand that that kind of verificationism has been out the window since the late 1950s, early 1960s.
They say, show it to me empirically, or I can test it with my five senses, and then I'll believe it.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Like, and I must say, too, that this revolution has yet to filter down to the man in the street. It's going to. It's starting to. I think, if I may say, one of the indications of this filtering down is that as I speak around the country, I find everywhere grassroots interest in Christian apologetics rising up among Christian laymen. People want to know about these things on the lay level. And that is a manifestation, I think, that this revolution is beginning to impact and will reshape American culture and society.
For more resources on this and many other topics from Dr. William Lane Craig, visit online to reasonablefaith.org. That's reasonablefaith.org.